Good afternoon again, everyone. The title of this month's Bible study presentation, The Four Horses of Revelation 6. Now, in order to give a little background for this, earlier we have taken a look at the story flow of the book of Revelation. We've looked and said, well, there are seven seals, and then there are seven trumpets, and on the seventh trumpet, there are seven vials or bowls. And then following that is the explanation of the Armageddon and the return of Christ. So we're going to take a look at the part of the seven seals. And really the first four of the seven seals are represented by the four horses of Revelation 6. So you'll want to put a marker in your Bible today on Revelation 6, because we're going to have frequent reference to that. So these seven seals, the first four are going to be the four horses of Revelation 6, and commonly referred to as the four horses of the apocalypse. I remember speaking with my niece, used to live in St. Louis. Her dad, my brother, was in Ohio, and she was in between, right in the middle. And we were talking, I think it was Winter Family Weekend, and about who's prepared in case there's an economic problem or a disruption in electricity, and who's prepared with regard for food and energy and so forth. I said, well, I live on a river. I've got 10 acres of woods. I've got a wood stove, and I've got this storage and all this. And my niece turns to my brother and said, Dad, in case of the zombie apocalypse, I'm going to live with Uncle Tim. So I had to think about that. You know, we all think of the apocalypse, this terrible time coming. Where did that come from? Why do people say that? Well, they're getting this from Revelation 6, where it's talking about a tough time to come. So if we're going to look at the four horses, we've got the white horse, the red horse, the black horse, and the pale horse. And we're going to look into those. Now, when I was 14, I had a horse. Horse was half quarter horse, half Welch, so it was in between. It was bigger than a pony, but not quite the same height as a horse. And I was 14, and of course, what 14-year-old country kid doesn't love a horse? And I had an opportunity. It was out on the far end, about a quarter mile from home, riding this bay horse, a reddish-brown horse with a black mane and tail. And her name was Queenie, and I'm riding. And now we had only one horse, and she really didn't see hardly any other horses. Well, I rode her along an alfalfa field about a quarter mile from home and rounded the corner of and next to a big cornfield, so she couldn't see anything. And wouldn't you know it, two neighbor kids were riding their horses in the road ditch. Now, my horse wasn't used to seeing other horses. And she saw these creatures, these other horses coming down with riders on them. And she turned around and bolted for home. I'm a 14-year-old kid. I'm hanging on for dear life, one of them, hoping that I can survive the experience. Did everything I could, but she wasn't going to slow down, galloping as fast as she could across the alfalfa field. And I thought, you know, you couldn't help but wonder, where are we going to go with this? Well, she was in a pen. But in order to get toward that pen or her corral, there was two what we call weeping elm trees. And if you're familiar with a weeping willow, these are weeping elms, low-hanging boughs that were, say, about 7 feet above the ground. And she's going lickety-split under one of those boughs. And I had a quick decision to make. Would I proceed on the horse and get smashed to smithereens? She's going at a full gallop. Or do I have to exit the saddle? This is not a happy thought. So about 20 feet before she went under the bow, I dived off. Fortunately, it was soft ground. And watched as she went right under the bow. And then Allie jumped right up in back over the corral. Didn't even know the horse could jump. And into her pen. Well, so when I see the explanation here about horses and having different capacities and different abilities and different circumstances, it brings back some memories. I didn't know a horse would bite me in the back of the head, but I learned that one too. You know, there were other things that I learned along the way. Well, these horses that we're going to take a look at today, each have are characteristic of some special event that's coming up. So of the four horses of the apocalypse, we're going to start with the first horse in Revelation 6, the white horse. Now, you will notice on this pictograph, this artist's rendering, there's a white horse, the rider has a bow, and he has a crown on his head. So let's take a look at Revelation 6 in verses 1 and 2. Let's open our Bibles to Revelation 6, verses 1 and 2. Now, we'd mentioned earlier that we're going to take a look at the first four of the seven seals. The first seal here represents the white horse, and we could say the white horse of deception. In Revelation 6, 1, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a voice like thunder, 'Come and see.'" Verse 2, "And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." Well, that's nice. It's a white horse, and somebody's going to conquer. People have done that throughout history, right? But what they're talking about here, we can reference another a Bible verse, and that's Matthew 24 and verses 4 and 5, to give us a little better explanation about this white horse, or we would say white horse of deception. So in Matthew 24, starting in verse 4, and this is, of course, Christ's prophecy in Matthew 24 of end time. "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many.'" And we think, well, that's silly. Everybody should obviously know who is or is not Jesus Christ. And yet, it's remarkable how many times through history that people have claimed messiahship. We're already in Matthew 24. Let's look at verse 24. Christ said, "Indeed, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." That should make our antenna wiggle a little bit here, right? If possible, even the elect. As we heard in today's sermon, we got to be careful, because is it possible for each of us? We don't want that to be possible, but here's the warning that it could happen. You know, over the years, a surprising number of people have claimed to be the ultimate Messiah. If I looked in Jewish Encyclopedia, they have five claimants. They list there to be Messiah claimants. And interestingly enough, the Jewish Encyclopedia says Jesus of Nazareth claimed to be the Messiah. And then they list four others. One was in the mid-first century. And another one was 135 A.D., there was another one in 1500, and yet another one in 1626. So they've had a number of people who have claimed that they were the Messiah. This is out of the Jewish Encyclopedia. Then if we take a look through other encyclopedias, there are 24 that made the encyclopedia realm for being a Christian Messiah. Now, and there are quite a few, and maybe more that just haven't hit the encyclopedia stage for being outrageous enough to do so. Well, of the 24, I'm going to pick out just a few of them. There was a fellow who was born in 1917, died in 1977, Samuel On Weyor, born Victor Emmanuel Gomez Rodriguez in Colombia. He later migrated to Mexico. And he founded the Universal Christian Gnostic Movement, and according to him, the most powerful movement ever founded. And by 1972, he predicted his death would occur before 1978, and sure enough, he died in 1977. So much for being the Messiah. There's the leader named An Sang-hong, the founder of the World Mission Society, Church of God. and the members all worship that person as their as the Messiah. However, their founder died in 1985. And then many of us have, may have heard of the Moonies. They're named after Sungmin Moon, and founder of the Unification Church. And they believe that he was the Messiah, and that he was the one that was anointed to finish the job for Jesus so that that would be done upon the return of Jesus himself. Then we, and just like I say, there are many of these. Then you may have heard of one known as Rael, a Claude Vorahan, called himself the Messenger of Elohim. Born in 1946, he was a professional test driver and a former car journalist. Became a founder of the UFO religion, the Rael movement in 1972. He taught that life on Earth was scientifically created by a species of extraterrestrials, which they called Elohim, and he claimed that he met an extraterrestrial humanoid in 1973 and therefore became the Messiah. And he devoted the task to what he said was his biological father gave him, which was an extraterrestrial he named, that he called Yahweh. So they're mixing up little bits and pieces of history to declare themselves a Messiah. Of course, some of us will remember, if we're old enough to remember, David Koresh, the leader of Branch Davidians in Texas, in Waco, that died upon the government intrusion to stop that. There's an Alan John Miller, born in 1962. Oh, that's pretty current. Let's see, how old would that be? 60 years old this year. Founder of Divine Truth, a new movement based in Australia, claims to actually be Jesus of Nazareth through reincarnation. He was formerly an elder in the Jehovah's Witness Church. There's no lack of people who are rising to claim themselves as a false Jesus. And then, of course, there's quite a few that are Muslim claimants to be a Messiah. Of course, this can't be just Jewish and Christian. Everybody else has to get on. There's nine that hit the encyclopedia stage. And then there's a Zoroastrian, which is an Iranian religion prior to Islam. And they've got a fellow who is claiming to be the Messiah at the outbreak of the or the expansion of the Islamic religion just prior to that. Then there are those that kind of blend a little bit of all these different religions, and they claim that they're the Messiah there. So, there are quite a few that when Christ said there's going to be false Christ and false prophets, he was on the money. There's many dozens of them. Many of them have, I suspect, haven't risen to the encyclopedia level yet with enough followers. So the first seal is the white horse of deception. We must be aware that there are many that, if it be possible, we could even be deceived. So religious deception, the primary verses to remember, of course, are Revelation 6, 1 and 2, and Matthew 24, verse 4 and 5. And then as we followed up, Matthew 24, 24. So after the deception, there's this great deception that's going to come around the world. There's going to be the next horse, and we'll turn to Revelation 6 in verses 3 and 4. And that horse, of course, is the red horse. when my reddish horse bit me in the back of the head, I immediately thought of this one right here. And the red horse signifies then a horse of war. If we take a look in Revelation 6, verses 3 and 4, the second seal, in verse 3, when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. In other words, the ability to do so by the people who were following him had the great capacity to do a great destruction. Well, as a student of history, I thought, you know, there's this is if this rates a red horse of the apocalyptic period, the red horse in Revelations, what's different between that war and every war in history? And there are many, many dozens. In fact, very few days in history or years in history has there ever been really been peace. So I looked up some of the most deadliest wars in human history. World War II. Somewhere between 40 and 72 million people died from 1939 to 1945. That's a lot of people. Okay. If we take a look, there was also the Taiping Rebellion in 1851 to 1864 to overlap the American Civil War. They didn't have close records then. They did have some census. They're projecting about 20 to 100 million people in China died about the same period of time as the run-up to and the period of the American Civil War. The third highest ranking death rate we're looking at is World War I, 1914 to 1918, between 15 and 65 million people. A lot of people and governments were damaged in such a way. So what we're looking at, this red horse, is significant in comparison to all of history and mankind. If we look at the fourth one, you may have heard of the Mongol conquests that affected Asia into Eastern Europe, the Middle East, from the year 1200 to 1472. There were waves of Mongol conquests to the point where today one out of three people of German heritage have the heavier epicanthal fold on their eyes, including myself. So that may be evidence of that, of the Mongolian hordes. That and killed about 30 to 60 million people is the best that they can come up with at that time. The fifth biggest death loss in war, again, is China, 13 to 36 million in the late 700s as they go through conflict. Well, today China's got 1.4 billion people. And so, hey, what's a few million here or there, right? Well, throughout history, millions and millions, dozens of millions have died, but there's been so many people that the population has replenished. If we go back now, number six is another war in China, from around 25 million people at the time when America was just getting founded in 1616 to 1662, about a 40, 50 year period when people were migrating across the Atlantic. 25 million people is a lot of people, and that's just the sixth highest ranked one. Then we have Timur the Lame, also called Tamerlane, also an Asian conqueror, somewhere between 15 and 20 million people. Each one of them was a human life with hopes and dreams and aspirations. I know he was particularly noted. He wasn't literate, but he kept staff along with him that recorded his conquests. And they recorded that one of his favorite things to do when he invaded an area was to make pyramids of human heads. And he liked to get 100,000 human heads in a pyramid as an indication of where he was and that he conquered. In 15 days, he did more destruction in Delhi, India, by destroying 100,000 people. It took him 100 years to regain the population in that time, and that would be in the 1200s, 12 to 1300s. So you have the eighth one, 8 to 12 million people, again in China, in the late 1800s, in a civil war there. The ninth most deadliest civil war is in Russia, from 5 to 9 million people, just at the close of World War I and into 1929, when the government collapsed, the Tsar was executed, and the Bolsheviks took over. A lot of people died in that revolution. We then take a look at the Napoleonic Wars, and now we're already to the 10th most deadliest wars in history, the Napoleonic Wars, and he ruled most of Europe, and the war extended into Asia, the Pacific, and Indian Oceans. It was on ships as well. Then 3,500 to 7 million people. But the deadliest war ever would be then World War II, that estimates to be, the latest estimates, over 56 million people around the world at that time. So here we have now a warning of a red horse, a sign of war. And we have that indication that it's going to be significant. So we can imagine the significance of this appearing in prophecy that will get people's attention. Now, if we take a look again, if we have our fingers in Matthew 24, we're going to keep referring to that. We have the correlation of Christ's prophecy in Matthew 24, starting in verse 6. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Meaning there's going to be more. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Meaning pretty widespread that this will occur. So the first two seals indicate the first two horses, the white horse for religious deception, the red horse with regard to war. Now let's go to the third seal. And the third seal is famine, and that's represented by the black horse. So we've got a white horse, a red horse, and now a black horse. And if we turn to Revelation 6, verses 5 and 6, we'll read about this particular black horse. In Revelation 6, in verse 5, when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart for wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius. That's a unit of currency. And do not harm the oil and the wine. In other words, be careful for what you have. Everything's going to be expensive. Been to the grocery store lately? It's all cheap now, because we still have food to eat. What happens when it becomes extraordinarily more scarce? Let's turn now. We've got to flip over to Matthew 24 and continue with Christ's prophecy that shows the parallels. In Matthew 24, verse 7, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. So we've looked at three particular seals, and each seal is represented by a different color horse and horseman. The religious deception of the white horse, the red horse representing war, the famine that follows the red horse is represented then by the black horse. Now, I took a look at the famines that were in the world, and I thought, well, there's quite a few here. I did not realize I had 22 or 23 pages, lists of famines throughout history. Well, this certainly is not gonna, I can't drone on and on about all the famines. They weren't sort of like the wars. There's a lot. So I just picked out the ones that killed a million or more people, a famine of lack of things to do. And the one that's listed is prior to the year 1000, the Mayan areas of Mesoamerica, Central America, over a million people died of a severe drought in what is now Guatemala and Mexico. And like I say, there are many of these with smaller numbers. There's a famine in Japan in 1230. Over 2 million people died there. There are the Great Famine of 1315 in Europe. 7.5 million people died at that time. There's a Chinese famine in 1333. 6 million people. They went to bed hungry and didn't go wake up. So I'm going to just zip through some of these because there are just so many. There was a Russian famine in 1601 to 1603. Over 2 million people died. And interestingly enough, this it said about half the Estonian population died as well. Of course, they're immediately adjacent to Russia. another famine in 1630 in India, over 7,400,000 people. And some of the numbers are is because leaders like to know how many people they have, so they did census numbers so they could count how much to tax their people and know where they're at. So we have some sense of those numbers. Korea in 1670, between 1 million and 1.5 million people. So this famine business has been happening regularly throughout history. France in this late 1600s, again, while early America was being built, 1.3 million people. Another famine in 1702 in India, 2 million people. I'm omitting the small ones. And then there was one in what's now known as Bangladesh, 10 million people in the Great Bengal Famine. 10 million people. Another one in India in 1783. Elsewhere in India, 11 million people. 1789, just 6 years later, a different part of India, 11 million people. You get the idea that famines are not new, and they have been existing throughout history. One of the more popular ones of public knowledge is the Great Potato Famine in Ireland. The sad part is they were exporting food during that famine. About 1 million people died, and about 1.5 to 2 million people emigrated, left the country because they could. And you say, well, how could they export food? Well, because Ireland didn't own its own property. The lords of England owned it, and they said, we collect the rent first, you can eat with what's left. So they collected the rent in the form of food production. So Ireland was exporting wheat, among other things, yet the people didn't have enough for themselves to eat. And that was in the middle 1800s, prior to the American Civil War. We have, and things we don't hear about, the Persian famine of 1870, up to 3 million people. And then there was a worldwide famine in the late 1800s in Chile, India, and Brazil. So I don't know if that's the same equatorial latitude, but they say 15 to 19 million people in the late 1800s. So we can go on, and there's millions after millions, and the famines keep going. So we'll run up to the current time. And, of course, in 1936, famine in China, 5 million people. Famine in Russia and Ukraine in 1932, 5 to 7 million people. Again, in 1928, 3 to 10 million in China. So this whole idea of famine with the black horse means it's coming in the end times, and people should be have a level of understanding of what Scripture is talking about. And we'll get to what's going to happen after that. So we've taken a look at the white horse, religious deception. We've seen the red horse of war, the black horse of famine, and now we take a look at the pale horse, and we're having disease epidemics. We're looking at the fourth horse in Revelation 6, the pale horse. Now, you can see this depiction, artist depiction, of a cloak, person with a cloak and a scythe, meaning the, as what people picture as the death angel to be. Because if you've got deception, what follows deception? Conflict and war. What happens during war? People don't have enough to eat. And if they don't have enough to eat, what happens? Now they're suffering from the diseases that arise or can be readily transmitted because they do not have strong immune systems, because when you don't have enough to eat or enough of the right things to eat, if you're eating only the same thing, you're going to have a nutritional imbalance. So we have this pale horse. Let's take a look now at Revelation 6, verse 7. And 8. So the fourth seal is the pale horse of disease. Verse 7 in Revelation 6. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come and see. So, verse 8, I looked and behold a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death and Hades, which is, means the grave, followed with him. And the power was given them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with hunger, with death and the beasts of the earth. So when somebody has been suffered from war, they've been deceived, the war, they've suffered from war, they don't have enough to eat, and now the pestilence comes in, you would think, well, that's not a singular event. That has to have happened before. Christ predicted this. We look in Matthew 24 and verse 7. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Well, I took a look at the list of epidemics through history, and I got to admit, I was astounded at the number of people that have died from what the King James term pestilences or diseases that have happened throughout history. And one of the leading causes of death is the Black Death, bubonic plague, that hit actually around the world, but substantially in Europe and Asia, but it's been every which where. We have around a fourth to a third of the people in Europe died of bubonic plague, transmitted by, it was in a bacterial disease, transmitted by rats, by the fleas on rats. And so that spread out. And you would think, well, if they followed God's hygiene laws, and didn't touch dead things and so forth, that wouldn't have been a problem. But you look at each of these steps, if people would have followed those cleanliness laws, that wouldn't have been an issue, but they didn't, which is why they blamed the Jews, because the Jews weren't dying at that time, because they were following the Levitical precepts. And so they weren't touching dead bodies, and if they did, they would wash and they would separate or isolate for a week, see if they came down with anything. And so, in fact, that's why the Jews were blamed and why there many of them were driven into Eastern Europe and Russia from Western Europe, which is why a number of my ancestors apparently pop up as Eastern Europeans and Russians. They must have been chased out of Western Europe and into Eastern Europe. Another one of the major, and we're looking at 75 to 200 million, by the way, dying of bubonic plague or Black Death. Spanish flu, again, the numbers are in 1918 to 1920, at the close of World War I, they're looking at, they're estimating somewhere between 17 and 100 million people. Spanish flu. My great-grandmother, my grandmother was born here in Gravette, Arkansas, and shortly after she was born, her father died, and my great-grandmother remarried. She had two little girls, so she remarried, and her new husband and her new baby son both died in the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918 to 1920. Lost them both. So that went the great hope. She was widowed twice before the age of 30. So it affected families all over the world. I know that they had an experimental vaccine at that time for Spanish flu, and they gave it to World War I soldiers and sent them overseas, and the vaccine promptly killed a whole bunch of them that they were sending off to fight in Europe, a sad circumstance. There were other bubonic plagues throughout history that have occurred in the middle 500s, what they call it, the plague of Justinian, as the demise of the Roman Empire, again, one of the waves of bubonic plague. And then you have other plagues that have hit, again, Central America, and I don't know how to pronounce the word, so I'm not going to butcher it. But you have the Central Americans, where it says somewhere between 5 and 15 million people died of that plague, somewhere in the early to middle 1500s. I know that it rearranged empires and leaders and so forth. So when nation rises against nation, kingdom against kingdom, what do we have? death, we have famine, and we have pestilences that come about. So, as we read now about these four horses of the apocalypse, or of Revelation 6, the white horse, red horse, black horse, and pale horse, you say, well, that's all pretty disgusting. I guess woe is us, we're all going to die, right? Or not. Let's read Romans 9, in Romans 9, verse 27. And we'll turn to Romans 9, 27. And the writer of the letter to the Romans is quoting Isaiah. Romans 9, 27, Isaiah also cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved. For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will make a short work upon the earth. So we have that there will be a remnant saved. How much is a remnant? Enough to tell what the original material was, right? Ever see a crazy quilt? I know that my grandmother would make them. Odds and ends, scraps of irregular pieces of cloth, whatever was left over, and she would just sew them all together, she and her sisters and friends, and they would get together with a frame, put it over the kitchen table, and they would take the remnants or scraps from all different materials. So I saw the quilts that they would make, and they were all, you have to be pretty artistic to figure all this out. I'm not gifted in that way, but they were able to put this together so that the remnants created a whole comfortable quilt. The remnant, now I've also done some interesting, there's an interesting book about one minute after, which is about what happens if there is an EMP, electromagnetic pulse. Now it's a fictional book about what happens if electricity goes out. And it's the book was, but the guy was a worked closely with the Pentagon and was very familiar with the scenarios that played out. And so he wrote this fictional book, Dr. Forrester wrote about 1 minute after, about what happens if all electricity goes out. Boom, electromagnetic pulse from a high altitude nuclear bomb. And all of a sudden, the lights go out, cars stop running because and everybody immediately reverts to the Stone Age, as it were. What a dramatic. And they go through, and it's, I found it interesting, that they said in this purely fictional book, which is drawing from the Pentagon studies, they said, well, as a result, about 30% of the people will die from violence because they're going to fight over the remaining resources. About 30% will die of famine. Not enough to eat. Another 30% will die of diseases, can't get medical treatment. But the Pentagon figured about 10% would be left at the end of the year, at the end of 1 year. And I'm going, where have I read this before? Well, it's right here. There will be a remnant that will be saved. And as we heard in today's sermon, it's up to us to decide whether or not we will be part of that remnant. Now, so if we take a look at the seven seals, the first four, represent the four horses, religious deception, the white horse, wars, the red horse, the famine is the black horse, disease epidemics are the pale horse. But the story isn't over because there are seven seals, and that means there's more to come. And so at some point we'll be able to talk about the tribulation, the heavenly signs, but ultimately there will be the seventh trumpet, the day of the Lord, for the salvation of mankind. In particular, our interest is in the remnant, because we obviously want to be part of that remnant. So the answer to all of these things is it's leading to the return of Jesus Christ. It's leading to the resolution of the conflict that man has brought upon themselves. And so as we read this, we must know that the hope is profound with the return of Jesus Christ.